The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Midpoint Library System, Clark County Public Library, and the Dayton Public Library.
Good morning. You are listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We have the Book Nook coming up for you this morning. And today, returning to the program, a writer from Denver, Colorado. She's originally from Toronto. Her name is Asma Zehanat Khan, and she has just published her second mystery novel in a series set in Toronto. It's called The Language of Secrets, and this is quite a story. We'll be talking to Asma about it coming up in the Book Nook this morning. But first, National Public Radio News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm delighted to welcome back to the program today Asma Zehanat Khan. Her second novel, The Language of Secrets, has just come out. She joins us by telephone from, where are you at, Colorado?
Denver, Colorado, that's right. Thank you so much.
Welcome back to the program, Asma.
Thank you.
When I had you on the show before, it was for your first novel, The Unquiet Dead. And I can recall from that conversation that that was a book that you really felt compelled to write that had been gestating for a long time. And now you've decided to make this into a series. So how did this happen?
Yes, I've decided to go ahead with the series. But I think that was really what I had always planned, because I had had these two characters in my head for such a long time, the two detectives, Issa and Rachel. And I felt like there were a lot of stories that I could tell using these two characters and that I wanted to tell. And the more I thought about them, the more they began to speak and tell those stories for themselves.
Let's talk about these two characters. This is a partnership. It reminds me a little bit of Ian Rankin's John Rebus and Siobhan Clark. It's an older man and a younger woman.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about them.
Well, Issa is the director of the community policing section, which is a policing unit in Toronto that investigates cases that are culturally sensitive or they're minority related. And Rachel is his partner, who's younger by about a decade, Sergeant Rachel Getty. And they're essentially complete opposites, which is really fun to write and allows for a lot of creative possibilities. He's more reserved and analytical, and he takes his time thinking about things and arriving at conclusions. And he has a different angle into any case that he's assigned to because he comes from a minority background himself. Rachel, on the other hand, is, you know, she's young, she's fresh, she's lively, she's full of bluster and courage, and she is very intuitive. So she often leaps ahead in an investigation and waits for Issa to catch up, in a sense. And so they sort of shape each other and bounce ideas off each other, and they're foils for each other. And they each add something that the other person lacks, which is what makes them so much fun to write.
As your story begins, there has been a murder in a remote area outside Toronto, and the victim is someone who Issa knew, someone who was a friend at one time. And Issa is called in, but he's really handcuffed, isn't he? He's not allowed to do anything.
That's right. I like putting him in these really difficult situations where he's constrained on all sides, because I think that allows for more dramatic and narrative possibilities. But in this case, he's been asked to investigate the murder of a man who was involved with a terror cell in Toronto. And I'm not giving away any spoilers to say that the man is actually a police agent who infiltrated the cell, and that's how Issa knows him. And so Issa, as a Canadian Muslim, and the murder victim as a Canadian Muslim, and the plot centering around a terror cell that's acting on jihadist ideology. These are all different conflicts that Issa has to face and to shape, and they're all different elements and aspects of his own identity that he has to tackle and confront. So he is not trusted because of his dual identities as a law enforcement officer and as a Muslim. And it's something that's very challenging for him because he has to investigate this murder without doing anything to derail the ongoing security and intelligence operation that's trying to take down the cell. And so he's not given information on a lot of sides, and he has to still try to achieve justice for his friend.
And we have the additional pressure that's created by the fact that the man who has been murdered, his father is sort of a rogue broadcaster. Tell us about him.
Yes, the murder victim's name is Mohsin Dar, and his father is Andy Dar. And Andy Dar is this interesting character because he's, you know, from the same religious and cultural background as both the murder victim and Issa. But he's rogue in the sense that he's disenchanted and he's sort of alienated from his own tradition and his faith, and he's incredibly critical of it. And so when his son is murdered in the woods, in the remote woods at Algonquin Park, he wants law enforcement to do something, but he also has a sort of cynical side where he has a national radio program and he wants to boost his ratings by turning this into a conversational piece that, you know, there's jihadists everywhere in Canada and we have to stamp them out and this is why my son was murdered. And because the security services, their investigation is still ongoing, they don't want anything to happen that will prevent them from carrying out a successful tactical operation. They need to keep the murder victim's father quiet on all these questions. And so that's really why Issa is invited into the investigation. He's told that you're only meant to give the appearance of investigating the murder, but your real job is to handhold this guy and prevent him from setting off a grenade in the middle of our investigation.
In case you've just tuned in, my guest in the Book Nook today is Asma Zehanat Khan. Her novel is The Language of Secrets. And this really is about language and secrets and poetry and puzzles, isn't it? I can tell that you're a person who has read deeply in the mystery genre just by the way you craft your puzzle. This is intriguing. Tell us about the connection with poetry. I learned a lot about poetry reading your book.
Oh, I'm really glad to hear that. Well, poetry is something that it's fascinated me all my life long for a number of different reasons. I come from a background and a tradition where poetry is part of our everyday lives. And, for example, I'm a South Asian woman. My family is from Pakistan. And you can, whenever you meet a Pakistani, every Pakistani you know can quote you some of the most famous poets of their day. They can quote you poetry in Urdu. They can quote you poetry in Persian. And so I grew up with that in my personal environment, listening to my parents recite poetry, read poetry, organize these beautiful poetry evenings called musharas, where everyone in the community would come. And this would be an occasion of celebration. And so it instilled in me from a really young age this love of the different ways that you can express language and express emotion, and sort of these very primal emotions come out through poetry. And then as I was growing up and I went through my studies, I actually did an undergraduate degree in English literature. So I was deeply fascinated by poetry, but I was always exploring poetry from other traditions and poetry in translation. And I would be this, you know, one lonely kid up in the stacks of the university library pulling out all these obscure volumes of Arabic poetry or Persian poetry or Urdu poetry or Turkish poetry and just thinking how gorgeous this literature was and how inaccessible it was to the public, and always finding that this was a part of life or a part of civilization that was closed off in the West, and wanting to bring those two worlds together. So it influenced me very much. It was always in the back of my mind that I would like to write something about these great traditions that I've been exposed to and been able to discover. And then the other thing that I wanted to do, because my book is essentially, the murder is about terrorism and a terrorist plot. And I find that this jihadist ideology that is so closely associated in the public's mind with the Islamic faith, it represents a culture of ugliness. And that's really all that we see. And to me, poetry was the antidote to that. It's a culture of beauty, and it's a way of speaking back both to that ideology and changing the narrative around these issues.
Living in this country, particularly right now as we have presidential candidates trying to sort themselves out, and we're hearing a lot of rhetoric and a lot of inflammatory language. As you observe and as you listen, it must be quite troubling for you as a Muslim.
Yes, I think it's a really difficult and dark period in American politics, and recently with the Canadian election in Canadian politics as well. And just generally, the discourse about Muslims in the West is problematic, it's troubling, it's divisive. In extreme cases, it's very ugly. Just yesterday, I was reading a story about a plan to build a Muslim cemetery and the backlash in the rural community that was hoping to build the cemetery there. And I was thinking to myself, you know, there's so much vilification in life, but the vilification continues even after death. So these are some of the themes that I'm tackling in the book that I think are urgent and timely and compelling. And I think what's maybe a little bit different about my book is that there's no shortage of, you know, Muslim bad guys in popular culture, whether it's a television show or a video game or a film or a book that you read, they abound. So this really isn't original material in a sense. What's original is that I'm looking at it from the perspective of a Muslim character, a Muslim police detective, and that my book has a whole range of Muslim characters from all sides of the spectrum with all kinds of ideas, with all kinds of contradictions as they tackle this anti-Muslim discourse and as they tackle the problematic ideology of jihadism. So I think that's a perspective you don't often hear in popular culture or in literature, or certainly not in political discourse, where Muslims speak for themselves and about themselves instead of being spoken to or spoken for. And I hope that it can shift the discussion a little bit.
Did you happen to see or hear about the latest episode of The X-Files that just aired this week, where it begins with a couple of young men, Muslim men, walking into an art gallery and blowing themselves up?
I haven't seen it. I'm a huge X-Files fan, so I've been waiting to see it. I've been so busy working on the current manuscript, I haven't had a chance. But I'm planning to look at it, and then I'm sure I'll have some thoughts on how it all plays out. I don't know if it's the usual trope of the Muslim bad guy who simply just hates our values and there's nothing more to the story, but I hope that it's more nuanced than that.
It's very nuanced. My guest is Osma Zehanat Khan. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. We'll continue with our conversation about her new novel, The Language of Secrets, right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. My guest today is Osma Zehanat Khan. Her book is The Language of Secrets. And your detective, your investigator, Issa, he's got a real problem because this guy who is his boss on this particular case doesn't seem to like him very much. What's going on there?
You're referring to his conflict with Cyprian Cole. Well, they have a history that I allude to in The Language of Secrets, which is that they used to work together on a national security team. And what I try to suggest in the book is that Issa has been more successful professionally and his career has advanced and, he's been in the public eye, and that's bred a certain kind of resentment and envy from some of his colleagues and certainly from this gentleman who's heading the anti-terrorism operation. And so, you know, you can read that on its surface as just a professional jealousy and just posturing between two men who both want to be in charge. But there's another level to it as well, where Issa suspects his colleague of holding anti-Muslim views and of subscribing to stereotypes that generalize and implicate all Muslims as terrorists. And he believes that's a big part of how Cole treats him and responds to him and why he doesn't really let him in on any details about the terrorism investigation that would help Issa with his murder investigation. So it's professionally complicated and it's personally complicated, but hopefully it adds drama to the story.
I think it does. And it also makes it a lot harder for Issa to do his job.
Yes.
And Rachel. True. And Rachel is working closely with Issa. And I obviously don't want to do spoilers here because there's a lot of potential to do that. But we do need to talk about the, quote, central bad guy in this one. We need to say something about him.
Okay, sure. Yes, his name is Hassan Ashguri. He's the leader of the terror cell. And that's, you know, not really a spoiler because that's the premise of the whole investigation, that this guy's heading up this cell and he has to be taken down.
So do we say anything else about him, about his connection to ISA? Do we just leave that to the readers?
Oh, that part.
Because that's kind of a...
I don't know if that's a spoiler or not. I'll leave that to your judgment.
That's sort of a spoiler. Okay, we won't say anything about that. Let's talk about Rachel. Rachel loves to play hockey. I love this. How Canadian.
Yeah, very Canadian, quintessentially Canadian.
What about her? Tell us about her. She's come from a troubled background. For those of us who have read the first book, she's had kind of a rocky family life. And in the first book, we learned a lot about her brother.
Yes, that's right. So Rachel's story, which I tell, I introduce it in The Unquiet Dead, the first book in the series, is that she is the daughter of a police superintendent named Don Getty. And, you know, he's enormously popular in the police service. He has a great reputation publicly. And he's a larger-than-life figure who's very dominating. But her story is essentially that her father is an abusive father. And though he hasn't been abusive to her, except emotionally, psychologically, he's been physically abusive to her younger brother as they were growing up. And her younger brother's name is Zachary. And then one day, her brother just disappears, and he goes missing for 7 years. And ever since he's been missing, Rachel has been looking for him. And this whole story is essentially told in The Unquiet Dead. And it's shaped Rachel's, you know, her attitude towards policing, her perception of the vulnerable, and it's made her, she's a very outwardly very strong and very resilient, but inwardly she faces all kinds of emotional challenges. She feels unloved, she feels insecure, she's always worried, she's always anxious. But the other part of the story is that it's really deepened her capacity for empathy in police work. And that's what makes her such a valuable partner to Khatak, is because she's suffered so much loss and she's known such suffering that she can immediately put herself in the shoes of a victim or a victim's family, and she can understand the interpersonal issues at play in a murder investigation. And I think that because even though she's young, that sort of gives her a maturity that's very much necessary in her line of work.
Asma Zehanat Khan is my guest. Her novel is The Language of Secrets. And one of the beauties of reading the mystery genre is when a writer is on it and doing it right and able to create that sense of tension, it makes us dread to turn the next page, but we also can't wait to turn the next page. And, and Rachel Getty, she's really good at creating tension for us, because when she is essentially asked to try to infiltrate the cell, she goes about it in such a way where we're going, oh, no, don't do that. Don't say that. She seems so naive in some of the choices that she makes.
That's what I mean when I say she sort of rushes into things headlong and she's led by her intuition. She'll push because she wants to get to the answer. She wants to help. She wants to solve. She wants to prove that she's useful, that she's a good police officer. But, yes, sometimes her enthusiasm puts her into very difficult and dangerous situations. But what I like about writing Rachel is that no matter how complicated or tricky her situation is, or whether she's actually in physical danger, she has confidence in herself that she's going to be able to find a way to get herself out of it, which may or may not be accurate, but just in terms of being inside of her head, that's really fun to write. And I think it helps me play with that tension a lot more.
For me, I like to pick out a favorite character who isn't a central character. And I would have to pick this young woman who was apparently formerly homeless, and she is very much a punk rocker. And I love this character because you really make us wonder, how did she end up at a mosque? Obviously, you have to read the book to figure that out, but she's got all the paraphernalia. She's got the piercings and the tattoos and the attire, and she's also really into cassette tapes. And I thought, Usma's totally on this, because cassette tapes are really making a comeback. It's bizarre.
Yes, I had done some research about the music scene that Grace would be into. The character's name is Grace. And I had come across that, and I had also come across something corresponding, which I can't give away right now, so which helped me really use them in the story. But yes, I had done some reading about the homeless in Toronto and about street kids. And I thought that a character from that background is a great way for Rachel to express her empathy and her interest. And it also connects Rachel back to the own story of her missing brother, who for all she knew was a kid on the streets for 7 years. So that I think that gives a richness to the interaction between Rachel undercover at the mosque and this kid who, through no fault of her own, has ended up in a situation where there's a terror cell inside a specific mosque. I like characters that are young and vulnerable and have to grow, but also have a certain life experience because their lives have been difficult. And I think I've really been influenced in that by the mystery writer Martha Grimes, who does a great job writing these teenage characters, and especially teenage girls who, you know, are not in a circumstance of having two parents to love them and support them and make them, help them to achieve their full potential in life, but actually have to be resourceful and depend on themselves and face all kinds of obstacles. So for me, that's really creatively very rich material. And I get really fond of these characters in The Unquiet Dead. There was two young girls, Hadley and Cassidy, who were teenage sisters, and I really liked writing them.
I remember them. They were the daughters of the man who mysteriously falls off the cliff.
Right, the stepdaughters.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, I also love the stepmother in that one. She was my favorite character in that story.
Oh, okay. Good to know.
The book is The Language of Secrets. Usma Zehanat Khan wrote it. And there's so much currency to this story. I'm guessing that maybe you had written it and then you went back in and kind of updated it a little bit, because we have mentions of ISIS in here and a very valuable author's note, I think. I think that anyone out there listening that has any questions about Islam or ISIS should read your author's note, because it explains a lot that I think people need to know.
Thank you so much. And that's so perceptive of you. Yes, I did have to constantly update this manuscript as events on the ground kept changing. And I remember there was a moment when I had asked my editor, I said, I know, you know, it's like the final stages and I'm probably way out of time to do this, but, you know, these and these things have happened. The Paris attacks have happened. And I think I need to address this in the context of the story. So can I go back and make some changes? And she very graciously allowed me to, although I'm sure she was pulling her hair out. And same thing for the author's note. I usually start out thinking about what are the themes that I want to address in my book. And I knew that this book was about political and religious themes and about current events in the Middle East as much as it was about a murder investigation in Toronto. So I had written my author's note very early on, and then I realized it was very incomplete and didn't really provide a coherent narrative or a coherent counter-narrative to what we typically see as commentary on the Middle East. So I spent a lot of time on that at the end again, to try to the things that you can't put into a novel, but that you want to be able to provide that context, I tried to do so there. And I tried to direct people to books that I thought were good if they're interested in these political issues. You know, they will provide a good grounding in those issues. And I'm also very fortunate because I'm married to an expert on the Middle East and on Islam and democracy. So whenever I have questions or I need something updated, I'm able to talk to him and ask him if I've got it right, and he can check my manuscript for errors or point out other areas that I should explore. That has actually, in the writing of this particular book, it was so immensely helpful. This poor man had to face maybe a year of nightly conversations about jihadism, but I think it really helped shape the book for the better.
Well, Usma, I hate to say this, but I'm guessing that probably one or two people who are listening right now aren't going to go right out and get your book. So for those two people, can we talk a little bit about some of this stuff that you mentioned in the author's note? Because I think it would be very informative for people who are out there listening to these debates and hearing our potential president saying things like, we're going to carpet bomb ISIS, and making these inflammatory statements. We're going to ban all Muslims from coming in the country. What is ISIS, in your view? Who are they? What are they doing?
Well, ISIS is a manifestation of what I would term the broken politics of the Middle East, which is one of the things that I write about in The Language of Secrets. is that these acts don't occur in isolation, and we can't truly understand them without some historical context. So ISIS is a jihadist group with a jihadist ideology, and it essentially is a successor to a former jihadist group, or a group that was formerly powerful called Al-Qaeda. And their ideology essentially states that the West is at war with the Muslim world, and they think in these very binary categories. So the Muslim world is a huge construct. It's incredibly diverse. It's not monolithic. It encompasses all these different societies and natures and languages and culture. But they think in these very binary terms, that there is a monolithic Muslim world and there is a monolithic West, and these two entities are at war. The West is at war with the Muslim world. And all Muslims should get together collectively to fight back and to defend themselves against this war of the West. And anyone who doesn't do so, whether they're in the tradition or out of the tradition, those people are enemies. And so they identify the West as the new crusaders. And they are convincing to a lot of people because of the legacy of the broken politics of the Middle East, meaning that, you know, the West supplies arms, it supports authoritarian states, it supported dictatorships. And from the perspective of the Muslim world, and certainly from the perspective of ISIS, there's been, you know, an invasion of Iraq and an occupation of Iraq. There's support for Israeli policies in the occupied territories. There's the war in Afghanistan. So there's this long legacy, this what I call a complicated intervention in the Middle East and in different parts of the Muslim world. And that's the material that a group like ISIS and other jihadist groups is able to use very successfully to recruit people to their cause. And what I'm trying to do in the language of secrets is to suggest that a facile characterization that they hate our values is simply too simplistic, and it doesn't provide any information, and it certainly doesn't provide a solution for the way forward. And in the language of secrets, with my character, Hassan Ashkouri, who's the architect of the terror plot in Toronto, I really get into the question of grievance and the legitimacy of grievance. Is there any legitimacy to these grievances about the Western encounter with parts of the Middle East or the Muslim world? And I have these characters explore that question to suggest things are not necessarily binary and they're not necessarily black and white. And it's a little difficult to do that because you want to be careful not to cross that line over into justification, but you also want to examine policies and the long-term impact of those policies and of the Western engagement with the Middle East or the Muslim world. So one of the things that I suggest through Hassan Ashkouri is that you can't occupy a country and bomb it and dismantle its infrastructure and leave it without nation building and then create this vacuum, having previously, you know, supported the dictator Saddam Hussein, who ran that country with an egregious human rights record, and then expect that to have no consequences for the people who live there and the people and for the thoughts of the people who live there about what's happened to them in their country. And that's what Hassan Ashkouri is essentially a figurehead for, to explore those ideas and to challenge that narrative that the West is uniformly good and the Middle East is uniformly bad, or that the West represents superior democratic values and Muslims don't aspire to those values. So there's a lot of dense and complicated material that I'm trying to pack into this novel through the lens of these different characters. And what I'm suggesting is that we have a long history of authoritarianism in the Middle East. There is really very little civil society infrastructure. There has been no democratic training, but there is a grassroots aspiration among people in these undemocratic societies for a life of freedom, for a life where their human rights are secured and guaranteed, and for change. And when those openings come, such as the Green Revolution in Iran or the Arab Spring in the Arab world, we see that there's a pushback from the dictators who want to cling to their power. And in that vacuum, where there's all this violence and repression and terror and misery, that's where groups like ISIS can flourish. So, of course, I'm not an expert on the Middle East, but these are the subjects that I'm exploring and trying to show from a variety of sides.
Well, as a reader here in America, it's very informative to read your fiction and to see these themes threaded throughout. The book is The Language of Secrets. Asma Zehanat Khan wrote it, and you're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. We'll continue our conversation right after this. It's the Book Nook on WYSO, and my guest today is Asma Zehanat Khan. Her book is The Language of Secrets. It's the second novel in her series set in Toronto with Detective Issa Katak and his associate, his fellow, I should say, female investigative assistant. Would you call her an assistant, Detective Rachel Getty? What is her actual title?
She's a sergeant, but I call her his partner.
Okay, her partner. And we were just talking about ISIS and some of these things that I think a lot of Americans just are poorly informed about. And one thing that our politicians love to talk about is they love to throw around the names Sunni and Shiite like they know what they're talking about. And in the book, you refer to something that happened that created this schism between these two groups, and it happened at Karbala. Is that correct? What happened?
Karbala, yes. I'm talking about, it's part of the history of Arabia. It's part of the history of the Muslim tradition, which is this battle where the descendants of Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, his grandchildren, Hassan and Hussein, and there's this paradigmatic event, this battle at Karbala, where Hussein should have been, as people in the Shia world certainly believe, but certainly among the Sunnis as well, there's a tremendous reverence for the figure of the Prophet's grandson. They believe that he was the natural successor of the Prophet and should have led the Muslim community. And in the Shia world, he's such a hugely important figure, he's referred to as Imam Hussein. But the caliphate at that time was led by a corrupt figure who lured these the family members of the Prophet into this battle and then essentially had them assassinated. And so he usurped the leadership of the Muslim community, and that's sort of the origin of sectarian division. But it doesn't mean necessarily that figures that are revered or important in the Shia tradition are not important in the Sunni tradition as well. It's just a different interpretation of history. And so the religion, you know, I'm not an expert on this either, but the religion essentially moves into these different grooves where, and there's a sense, again, of grievance, of an injustice being done and having never been atoned for. And that's such an important, emotionally significant figure to the entire Muslim tradition, should have been treated so egregiously and betrayed so horribly, and had his family and friends executed like this. It's considered a turning point on the calendar of Islam, and it's hugely influential.
You've indicated in our conversation that Islam is a very diverse religion, that there are many different types of it and many different people who respect these traditions. And a point that you make in your author's note that I think we need to make clear to our listeners is that this is not a religion of terror. This is not a religion of violence.
Well, yeah, one of the things I try to say in my author's note is that, and sort of in the book as well, it's a point that the characters make in the language of secrets, is that religious traditions are essentially silent, and we bring something to them. So whatever our training is, however we understand the world, whatever our ethical perspective is, what our framework is for interpreting scripture and carrying out practice, that's something we bring to religion. So we can bring the most violent and nihilistic and hateful interpretation, intolerant interpretation, or we can bring something that's humanizing, communal, uplifting, pluralistic, and so that's a big part of what the language of secrets is trying to say, that there is nothing inherently violent in the religion of Islam. There are groups like ISIS who have cherry-picked it to promulgate a violent interpretation, but there's just as many, you know, or I mean overwhelmingly the majority of Muslims don't see religion that way. They see it as a useful force in life. They see it as something that uplifts them, that is positive, that can change their communities, that is transformative in a way, but transformative for the greater good, for personal good and for the greater good. So I'm trying to suggest that it's impossible to box up Islam or its practitioners into these narrow categories and to paint them all with one brush, because in any of the political discourse about Islam or Muslims, and certainly in the United States, just imagine substituting the word Jews for Muslims and think how that would play out. Could we possibly generalize about another group this way? I don't think so.
Well, if it was 1932 in Germany, we'd give it a try, wouldn't we? My guest is Asma Zehanat Khan, and we're talking about her new novel, her mystery, and I think that Toronto is a wonderful place to set these stories. This is such a big multicultural place, and it's a place that you know very well, isn't it?
Yes, Toronto is my hometown.
It's a beautiful city, isn't it?
It's a city I love. I mean, I always think of it as home. I go home several times a year. I spend a great deal of time there. I'm very comfortable there. What I love most about it is its multiculturalism. I love the fact that wherever I go, there's so many languages, there's so many faces of color, there's so many different cultural customs, and they're sort of integrated into a whole that I think is primarily joyful and enriching and celebratory, which is not to whitewash it or say that there is nothing negative or there aren't any tensions between communities, because that's the reality of every community everywhere in the world. But I think in Canada and in Toronto, those things have been they've been negotiated over a long time and with some success. So I always feel at home there, and I think my detectives do as well.
You mentioned earlier that you were busy writing. Are you working on a third book in the series?
Yes, I am working on the next Issa and Rachel mystery, where I send Issa to Iran to explore the Shia traditions of Islam and to feel what it's like to be in the minority for once.
Wow. That's going to be a departure. How's that going?
It's going well. I'm almost done. I'm just about, maybe in the next couple of days, to hand it off to my editor for her comments. And I will be relieved to set it behind me. But it was a great book to write, because what I actually really wanted to write about was political prisoners. I've been exploring this world of, I have a human rights background, so I'm very interested in the situation of prisoners of conscience and prisoners who are detained for political reasons and what they endure. And of course, the story of Jason Rezaian of the Washington Post was a big story here in the United States. So I was interested. I'm also interested in the tension between America and Iran and the kind of dialogue that surrounds that tension. These are all things that I wanted to explore. And because Issa comes from a majority tradition in his faith, I wanted him to see what it's like to be on the other side, where you're not the majority and where people don't respect your tradition or may not respect your tradition, where you have to be the person who's uncomfortable and figuring things out and trying to find accommodation. Because I think we have a tendency to get very comfortable and assume that the world is built for us, and it's great to be able to put a character in somebody else's shoes and discover that's not the case.
So this is it. When you meet a stranger and they ask you, what do? Do you say, I'm a writer?
I do now, yes. For a long time, I used to say I'm a lawyer or I'm a teacher, but now I say I'm a writer.
That's wonderful. Well, I was tickled when I got to the end of your book and I read your acknowledgments. At one point, you say, many thanks to Ryan Warner at Colorado Public Radio. And Ryan worked here at this radio station about 15, 16 years ago. He was our host for Morning Edition. And I've been doing this program. I started doing it in 1994. I know Ryan used to listen to it. I used to interview authors every weekday. And I'm thinking that now that he's interviewing authors, he must have been influenced or inspired a little bit by listening to this program.
Oh, I'm sure he was, because he's so good at it. And he paid so much attention to the details of the book, just as you have. So I'm sure it was a great training ground for him.
Doesn't he have a series where he does interviews in the Tattered Cover bookstore? Didn't you do an interview with him in there?
Yes. Yes, that's exactly how it played out for me. It's called Colorado Matters, and he discusses books with their authors, and it's a public conversation, and people come and hear it, and then there's a Q&A after. So it's just a wonderful way to discuss books and to talk about literature and have some public engagement, because those opportunities are so rare. So it was a lot of fun. It was a great opportunity.
That sounds wonderful. And I'm guessing that you have drank deeply at the well of this genre. Do you read widely in it? Are there some authors that you really like that you might recommend?
Yes, I love mysteries, and I read them incessantly. I used to really, really love Reginald Hill, who's the late, great Reginald Hill. I thought his books were just masterful. And I also like a lot of other authors. I love Deborah Crombie. I love my fellow Canadian writer, Louise Penny. I love her stories and her detective. Gamache, he's a great character. There's a new writer I've discovered called Ashley Weaver. I like her books. Oh, my list is endless. Alan Bradley, Peter May, Charles Finch,
Charles Todd, Elizabeth George.
We just had Charles Todd on recently for his, or I should say Charles Finch on recently for his little Victorian series that he does. And you're on a great imprint for this.
Yes. Yes, I love his books. I love the setting. I think his books are, I actually don't even care that much about the mystery because the atmosphere is so beautiful. And I loved his book that was set in Oxford, the September Society.
Well, it's really been a pleasure having you back on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about my book.
My guest has been Asma Zehanat Khan. Her second novel in this series is The Language of Secrets. It's got a great cover. It looks like you're out in the wilderness in Canada. It's winter time. Maybe a full moon. It's a great cover.
Thank you. Yes, the person who designs them is brilliant, and I think it perfectly captures the first chapter of my story.
Are we looking at maybe another year from now for the third book?
That's right. It should come out in the winter season of 2017.
Well, hopefully we can have you back again.
Thank you so much. I would love that.
Thank you. That was really a treat to talk to Asma again about her book, her new book in this series, The Language of Secrets. And we have a little extra time this morning on the program, and I do have a stack of book-related news here, and I normally don't do this. I normally don't have time, but I figure this is some important book news, and I'd like to share it with you. We have the Big Read starting next week. As many of you probably know, the Big Read is our celebration of reading and conversation in the Miami Valley, and the book that was chosen this year was a book written by Christina Baker Klein, and she's going to be in town next Wednesday for an event at Books & Company at the Green at 7 o'clock. Her book is called Orphan Train. That is the book that was chosen for the Big Read, and a lot of people will be reading this together between March 6th and April 16th. At libraries, schools, and other locations across the region, there will be discussions taking place about Orphan Train, and we're hoping to obtain an interview with Christina next week when she's in the area. And if we do that, we'll run it for you this coming weekend. Also coming up, the Friends of the Library, the Washington Centerville Public Library, are having a big event. And this is taking place on Thursday, March 10th at Yankee Trace Banquet Center. And there will be a bunch of local authors there for this event, including Mindy Arnett, John Ballard, Ph.D., Rob E. Boley, Louise Borden, Molly D. Campbell, Ann Hagedorn, Will Hillenbrand, Ryan Ireland, Katrina Kittle, Trudy Krischer, Jessica Lemon, Herbert Woodward Martin, Hal McCoy, C.L. Powells, Edward J. Roach, Sharon Short, Joanne Huis Smith and Tim Wagoner. And this is a fundraiser by the Friends of the Washington Centerville Public Library. So if you want ticket information, you can obtain that obtain that at their website, wclibraryinfo/friends.info/friends. And I will be the MC for this event. That's Thursday, March 10th at Yankee Trace Banquet Center, from 6:30 until 8:30. And if you attend, there will be deluxe hors d'oeuvres, wine and beer samplings, desserts, and a Nook e-reader raffle. And I plan to be there. I'll be the MC, so hopefully I'll see some of you there. If you do come by, say hello. Also coming up, Holmes, Doyle, and friends are to meet. I just got this email from Kathleen, who is a member of the AGRA Treasurers, and this is from the press release. Quote, few literary characters have caught the imagination of the public, as has Sherlock Holmes. A century and a quarter after he appeared in the pages of The Strand, one of the newer magazines developed to appeal to the growing and newly literate middle class in Britain, Holmes and Watson still dwell in the imagination of readers. He has appeared in 56 short stories and 4 novels by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, as well as many films, a stage play, and TV shows. He has also spawned a cottage industry of parodies, pastiches, analyses, and groups of devoted followers in local chapters of the Baker Street Irregulars. In our local group, the Agra Treasurers out of Dayton will have their third annual convention for such followers, and this will be on April 15th and 16th at the Clarion Airport Inn, 10 Rockridge Road in Englewood, Ohio. And there will be a Get Acquainted reception. The program will feature all kinds of things about Sherlock Holmes and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, various aspects of Victorian life and literature. And this is an event you'll need to register for. There are some costs involved. You can find out by going to their website, agratreasurers.net. Agra is spelled A-G-R-A. And the Agra Treasurers, according to the press release, having grown and mutated from the Sherlock Holmes Enthusiastic Readers League on Criminal Knowledge that was founded at Wright State University in 1973, meet every 2 months for dinner and a lively discussion of a Sherlock Holmes story and other facets of Victorian England. New members are always welcome at the Agra Treasurers' bi-monthly meetings, featuring conversation, talks about Sherlock Holmes or Victorian London, and a quiz and discussion about one of the Sherlock Holmes stories. Sounds like fun, doesn't it? That's agratreasurers.net, and they will be having this event April 15th and 16th at the Clarion Airport Inn in Englewood. And they note that this will have a reservation-only dinner, and spouses or friends who come with Sherlockians but don't want to attend the conference can enjoy various nearby attractions such as shopping, the National Museum of the United States Air Force, or walking and bird watching at Allwood Audubon Nature Center or the Englewood Metro Park just across the Englewood Dam from the conference. And such companions are also welcome to obtain a ticket to the dinner. I love Sherlock Holmes myself. That sounds like a fun, fun event. And we have a birthday party coming up. Blue Jacket Books will turn 10 years old, and they're going to have this party in Xenia. Blue Jacket Books, just across from the courthouse. They're on the square in Xenia, Ohio. And they'll be having this on Friday, February 26th, from 5 until 8 o'clock. I just saw a note from one of the owners, Lawrence, over at Blue Jacket. And he wrote, "Please bring your own potluck item to share. We'll provide the bubbly and non-alcoholic beverages, too. It'll be kids and old folks friendly. Massages will be provided if you want one. And you will enjoy the musical treatments of the Sonic Youths, who will provide pep and substance, light and sound, verily." Not to be confused with the band Sonic Youth. The Sonic Youths will be performing. That's at Blue Jacket Books on Friday, 5 to 8 p.m., February 26th, turning 10 years old. And that's it. That's our book calendar. A very infrequent, very irregular, don't expect to hear this again for a long time event here on the Book Nook. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. As always, thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in tomorrow morning at 10:30 as we talk to Fiona Barton about her sensational new novel. It's called The Widow.